Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 287 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Stephanie Norgate explores her practice of keeping notebooks, relishing the unexpected jewels they produce, and sharing her fascination with the notebooks of other writers and the remarkable insights they can provide. Here she is with notebooks, cameras, and chafing dishes.
My daughter and I are sitting on the steps of the Duomo in Bologna. Francesca is drawing in her sketchbook when a couple with a small movie camera hover behind her. The man lowers the camera over her shoulder and aims the lens at her page. "Keep drawing," the wife orders her. "Go on." They have an ambition to record her moving hand in their film. Francesca laughs and I start to laugh. She closes her sketchbook. The movie makers are disappointed by her attitude. She tells me that when she's drawing in the British Museum or the National Gallery, tourists crowd round her taking photographs. They're excited by an artist practicing their art. On the same holiday, I'm sitting on a cobbled street in Fermo. I've left the tour of the Roman cistern, a hilltop, man-made cavern of rooms built to store water. The damp underground air has affected my breathing. But never mind, I have my blue notebook and my fountain pen. I want to make notes because the cistern is full of the contradictions that a poet loves. 5 minutes in and I'm startled by the click-click of a camera behind me. A man is aiming his lens at my notebook. "It's a wonderful photograph," he says. "It has come out so well." He expects me to join in his rejoicing. Then, without showing me, he runs away. I'm waiting to meet Francesca in the Royal Festival Hall Cafe, a place where other coffee drinkers tap away on laptops. My daughter is late, so I open my green notebook and join the writers around me. After a few minutes, I sense I'm being watched. Am I imagining it? No. Over by the gift shop, a man is focusing an elephant trunk of a lens on my notebook. We clock each other. I close my notebook. He lowers his heavy camera and drifts off. I'm on a train to Bristol writing in my red notebook. Well, you can guess the rest. These incidents make me ask why we're so fascinated by the processes of creation. Why do people want to photograph artists while they draw? The desire to photograph a drawing, as it almost magically appears on the page, is more understandable than wanting to photograph the act of writing. Is there something quaint about analogue methods? Is handwriting a dying art form, the image of which should be archived for posterity? Everywhere writers work on laptops, but are probably not the subject of photography. But isn't the camera itself a kind of notebook? While my notebook contains my rough impressions, it has become a note in someone else's visual collection. I have some sympathy with these photographers. As a creative writing lecturer wanting to help students, I discovered more about the different practices of writing from reading writers' notebooks than from reading how-to books on craft. And as a writer of my own notebooks, I'm encouraged by reading those of others. So why do I prize notebooks, journals, diaries and letters, where writers record both their lives and their source material? What is it about those raw notes that attracts me? Is it somehow the desire to experience with the writer the first spark that fires the finished work? I can't claim to read journals and notebooks in a scholarly way. I dip into them randomly and achronologically. While it's rewarding to recognise the seeds of, say, the swimmer, John Cheever's famous story, I'm not seeking the roots of a finished piece for critical purposes. Rather, I think what I enjoy is the exploration of a writer's sensibility. Firstly, there's the matter of the writer's zeitgeist. John Cheever, David Gascoigne, Virginia Woolf and Sylvia Plath all communicate a sense of their times, whether it's the amount of alcohol consumed in Ossining in the 60s, being hungry in Paris in the 30s, the pleasure of visiting Mrs. Plum in Devon in 1962, an episode that shows Plath's warm understanding of other women and makes me like both her and Mrs. Plum. These writers communicate live moments from their times, mixed up with personal crises and developments. A diary differs from a historical novel, where a writer has researched and selected details to include. In journals, a writer has no sense of temporal distance, but dashes down immediate moments. On 13th of October 1936, David Gascoigne suffers a raging toothache, wakes in the sordidness of an after-the-party room, and takes part in an anti-fascist procession to Alexandra Park. Hears fascists shouting anti-Jewish slogans in Green Street, and sings the Internationale at dusk in St. James Park, where a great crowd stretched away towards the surrounding trees, dotted with red flags and banners. The entry for 21st of October 1936 includes an expired railway ticket, staggering round to deliver surrealist bulletins, encountering annoying friends, descriptions of walkers on Hampstead Heath, and a tantalising reference to my wild and much-loved godmother, whose grave is in the cemetery which the bus passed by. Who was she? How did she die? What form did her wildness take? A journal writer has no need to explain, and a life leaps off the page, a present grief in the writer's memory. Like Stendhal's mirror, the journal is the view from the bus passing by. In the introduction to Cheever's journals, his son tells us that Cheever feverishly typed his journal pages, with floating caps, misspellings and crossouts. And yet the writing within these pages is elegant, disturbing, poetic, full of painfully honest self-analysis. As someone who typed his journals, Cheever probably wasn't writing them in streets, cafes or outside as I often do. Yet Cheever's present tense draws me into his personal experiences, as if they are synchronous with the act of writing up. He is always the artist, and whether reflecting on his own nature, sexual longings, religious faith, alcoholism, or engagement with the quotidian world, he finely observes and dramatises each situation. In 1959 he writes, "The lower school here burns down, a rambling frame building with turrets and amendments, saturated in creosote, it seems to explode in flame. Then minutes after the old teacher smells smoke, it is a pillar of fire. The firemen can't approach it, the heat is so intense. All the surrounding trees can be seen to wither. Here is the savage power of fire, the smiting force, which, like so much else in life, evades precautions and is ruthless. Within half an hour everything is gone, the clothing, the children's toys, the souvenirs of travel and athletic prowess, the rich precipitate of their lives. At 3 o'clock they possessed an environment. At 3:20 they are naked and dependent upon charity, the bitter smoke." There are layers here in this extract. Cheever embeds the damage to three generations, the old teacher, the firemen and the children. He credits the power of objects and spaces that give meaning to daily life. But the masterstroke is the bitter smoke of mortality that follows us all. I'd never have read this if I hadn't dipped into the journals, where every observation forms a bridge between Cheever's inner apprehension and his exterior world. For me, the passage justifies, not that it needs to, time spent on notebook writing, observing, and creating fragments. These unexpected jewels are heartening when reading other writers' notebooks, where a sense of place and time is so powerfully rendered. In Virginia Woolf's diaries, we see the writer's creative mind, interrupted by relatives, by the fascinations of walking through London, by tea at Charleston, but ever returning to fictional composition. In 1923, Virginia Woolf is at work on both Mrs. Dalloway, or The Hours as she was calling it then, and The Common Reader. Her diary entries switch between notes and queries about both books. On August the 17th, she writes a list of headings and authors to consider in the Common Reader. On August the 29th, she reflects on her progress with the Hours. On October the 15th, she says, "I am now in the thick of the mad scene in Regent's Park. I find I write it by clinging as tight to fact as I can, and write perhaps 50 words a morning. This I must rewrite some day." Wolfe's methods, daily amounts of writing, creative problems, interruptions, and the switching between a journalistic book on reading and a novel are fascinating. Despite her thinking the design remarkable, she questions her creation of Mrs. Dalloway's character. Here, Wolfe mentions her famous tunnelling process, the way in which she tells the past by instalments, as I have need of it, and takes a stab at Percy Lubbock's idea that a writer can plan a book consciously. Wolfe detests the idea of systematised writing. "I too love the messy processes of writing and resist the notion of rules, which is why I gain more from Wolfe than handbooks on novel structure." The agility of her switchback associative mind is bracing and inspiring. Wolfe's constant interrogation of her own writing process and her description of it, interspersed with accounts of conversations, discussions about reading, visits, descriptions of weather, city and countryside, urge her on to complete the work. The diary becomes almost a writing coach, a mentor, a dialogue of the everyday self with the writer self. Wolfe frequently reflects on her word count, her goals in terms of dates, weeks and days. No wonder she wrote novels called originally The Hours and The Years. Everything in her diaries attests to her fascination with time. Open any page and there will be a reference to time, whether it's lunch, an appointment, the season, the counting of days left to finish a book, a date of publication, a comment on age or history, the time taken to write 100,000 words. Somehow, reading Wolfe's diary, all kinds of writing seem possible within the varied confines of measured time. If Wolfe and Cheever mix accounts of life and writing in their journals, Henry James, at least in my edition of his notebooks, focuses on working out his characters. He takes a dilemma and puzzles at it. On November the 3rd, 1894, James writes of the situation of some young creature, it seems to me preferably a woman, but of this I'm not sure, who at 20, on the threshold of a life that seemed boundless, is suddenly condemned to death by consumption, heart disease or whatever, by the voice of the physician. This is James working out the scenario and characters of the three protagonists in The Wings of the Dove. Out of character comes action, and James works intensely on character contradictions before naming and placing his cast. James began as a playwright, and his methods of working out choices, inner problems, social pressures, and the cross-play of action before he embarks on the actual novel writing is reminiscent of a playwright's method. James argues with his own ideas, saying but or as he tries out different scenarios and backstories. He has no income and she no fortune, or there is some insurmountable opposition on the part of her father, or say they simply have no means. There are many dashes and interjections, snatches of dialogue, the weighing of one option of action against another, and worries about the crudeness of the plot. Early on, he'll say, "I cannot see it yet," but the very writing of the notebook entry helps him to envisage his story. As the notes continue, James comments, "I seem to see a penniless peer who my elder girl refuses." The tone becomes less tentative, more decided. She is eager, ready to marry now. He's in distress. And towards the end of his entry, James says, "I seem to see her, perhaps, as an American." It's an exciting read because the shape of the novel and the characters form before the reader's eyes. James works initially without names for characters or places and then weighs up names from lists. In 1899, he has some fun with this list. Pickerel, Chafer, Bullet, Whitethorn, Dash, Elsinore, Deuce, Doveridge, Adney, Twentyman, Firminger, Wayward, Wayworth, Grayswood, Nona, Runting. The continuing list, too long to recite here, is as rhythmic as a poem. To write this article, I've spent some time in the company of Plath, Gascoigne, Wolfe and Cheever, and finally I'm glad to return to novels and completed published poems. The writer's voice in their notebook is confiding, tentative and often insistent. The finished work intended for public readership is less directing and self-questioning, more shaped and paradoxically more open to the reader. Yet I know I'll still be dipping into the delights of Rebecca Elson's notebook entries, or Elizabeth Bishop's prose, or Virginia Woolf's self-questioning, or marvelling at the moment where Du Maurier's nameless heroine in the Rebecca notebook suddenly slips from third to first person, and in that instant takes on a life strong enough to voice the narrative. I'll still be writing my own notebooks, listing plants from a walk, or writing seasonal notes, or racking myself over past mistakes, or trying to unpick difficult situations, or noting down political events. I always thought that if I'd kept a notebook at an earlier age, I would have made wiser decisions, behaved better in personal relationships, and worked out my writing as well as my life more successfully. I'd like to be able to say that keeping a notebook is cathartic, moral, a mode of survival, but that can't be proved. Wolfe and Plath committed suicide, and Cheever and Gascoigne often thought of doing so. But who knows whether their notebooks kept them going at key times. Gascoigne lived till he was 85, but was desperate at the age of 21. As Wolfe says, the question is how to get the work done. And when I read these notebooks, I'm confronted by the writerly hooks that catch the fish, the energetic interrogations and observations of writers' minds. There are no rules. Lists are fine. Messy, overlong, periodic sentences are fine. Shouting at yourself is fine. Wolfe tells us that she enjoys everything. Yes, because of the writer's eye, curiosity, and the chance to get it down in a notebook. Flip the book open, start anywhere. On January the 28th, 1778, the naturalist Gilbert White, whose journals were the first I read because of my Selborne childhood, wrote, "Frost comes innerdoors. Little shining particles of ice appear on the ceiling, cornice and walls of my great parlour. The vapour condensed on the plaster is frozen, in spite of frequent fires in the chimney. I now set a chafing dish of clear burnt charcoal in the room on the floor. My notebook is the chafing dish that melts the ice and holds the charcoal when I begin to write."
That was Stephanie Norgate. You can find out more about Stephanie on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 287, which was recorded by Jane Draycott and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 288, Stephen Romer speaks with John Greening about poetry, life in France, and working with deeply personal source material. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.